Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason. This is the Reason Podcast, and today we are talking with the head of the Libertarian Party, Nicholas Sarwark. He is in Arizona. He's going to be going up to Las Vegas in a day or so to check out the final presidential debate. Nicholas, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me on, Nick.
You are going up to check out what you affectionately call the clown show. This is the third and final presidential debate that's taking place on Wednesday in Las Vegas. What are you hoping to do up there?
You know, the same thing that I was trying to do when I went out to Long Island for the first of the Commission on Presidential Debates, rigged debate. It's an opportunity to meet with activists. There's a lot of reporters that cover the debates, even though they are very scripted. And so it's a media opportunity to talk about the just sheer unfairness of excluding a candidate who's on all 50 state ballots. And it's a good way to rally the troops.
Let's start first talking about Johnson and Weld. These guys are doing better. I mean, it's got to be 500%, 1,000%, infinity better than any other Libertarian Party candidates have done. And yet you hear again and again, or I read again and again, including today, there was a piece in The Week that was talking about, you know, the Johnson-Weld campaign is a faceplant. You know, it didn't catch fire. How do you feel about it?
You know, I see those same sort of concern trolling articles. They usually come from people like the one in The Week who aren't Libertarian Party members, who have never been interested in being part of the Libertarian Party. And it's this weird narcissistic, look at me, why aren't they appealing to me? Why aren't they talking about my issues? You know, and calling them a failure because they don't choose to target, you know, particular writers or people who, you know, want to be convinced. I don't think that is a fair assessment. If you break out of that kind of narcissistic view, you look at them and they're running about 10 times better, at least with the polling numbers I'm seeing, than any prior Libertarian presidential campaign. And, you know, the party membership and revenue are both up almost 100%.
So talk about what are the numbers for how many people are now dues-paying members of the Libertarian Party?
In January, we were somewhere in the 11,000-12,000 mark. And I believe the last full month I got, which was either last month or the month before, we were pushing on 20,000. Mm-hmm. So nearly we'll double before the year's done.
On some level, that's 100% increase. That's great. On another level, it also kind of underscores how few dues-paying members you need to be America's third largest party. But hopefully, that's changing. And we'll see a million flowers blooming or 1,000 flowers blooming. Why do you think Johnson and Weld are doing as well as they are? And again, this is, you know, this isn't being Pollyannish. It's that, you know, even 4 years ago, Gary Johnson struggled to poll in more than, you know, at 1% in the polls. He ended up with about 1% of the popular vote. It seems unfathomable that he wouldn't. You know, he won't crack 5% this time around. But why is the Libertarian message actually hitting in a way that it did not 4 years ago?
A lot of it has to do with the competition. You know, anytime if you study scientific marketing and advertising, one of the concepts that's really key is this idea of a unique selling proposition. You have to provide some differentiation if you want people to select your product over the other ones in the marketplace.
And if I may, the ultimate USP, which comes out of David Ogilvy, the great ad man, was that M&M candies melt in your mouth, not in your hands. Johnson and Weld, they melt in your mouth, not in your hands. What is their unique selling proposition or the LP's unique selling proposition?
So it's a unique selling proposition that would not be unique in any other election. But when you're running against the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee, both of whom are fake and will say anything in order to win and are just, you know, corrupt and are willing to lie if necessary. And, you know, in the case of the Democrat, willing to do pretty much anything in order to grasp power, then the middle of the road, two-term Republican governor of Democratic states, what normally would not be something that would stand out in the marketplace. It would just be similar to one of the old party candidates and not elicit that kind of jump off. In this election, that's very different. Someone sane and honest is different. And so I think a lot of it just comes down to integrity and trust. That's what a lot of our polling is showing. Mm-hmm. But there's also just a rejection of this idea that the government should be controlling us. You know, a lot of the Sanders support was not support for things like, you know, government action on climate change policy or free college. It was support for this idea that we should stop having wars overseas, that we should stop locking up African American men for using weed, that we should stop, you know, this politics of destruction that the old parties both agree on. You know, they agree on much more than they disagree on.
In John Oliver, on Last Week Tonight, in its most recent iteration, he poked fun at Gary Johnson and he said, you know, there's a lot to like there. He's in favor of legalizing marijuana. He's against police militarization, and he wants sentencing reform, a bunch of other things. But then he said, you know, if you scratch the surface, he wants to cut the government. He's not kidding about that. How do you appeal to voters, particularly young voters, when you say, look, this is the deal. You know, I'm going to give you a lot less than all of these other people. How does the LP, or how do candidates turn that into a positive? Aren't we used to, you know, having the government act as Santa Claus?
We are. And the reason that Johnson is leading amongst actual independents, non-leaning independents, he's in first place, and leading, or, you know, in second place amongst young people, is they value this commodity that's so rare in politics of authenticity and honesty. So a candidate who's willing to go out and tell you the truth, that entitlement spending is not sustainable with our current demographics, that we can't give free stuff, that government-subsidized, non-dischargeable student loans do nothing other than raise the price of education, that the solution to a problem we agree on is not actually a solution and will just make the problem worse. You know, going out and being honest with the voters has an appeal that's growing, is not a majority right now, because a lot of people want Santa Claus to come and help, and that doesn't differentiate between Republicans and Democrats. You know, when you have revealed preference in what they actually vote for and what their candidates do, it's very clear that both of those parties agree that a bigger government is the solution. And the Libertarian Party is the only one that's standing out there saying, look, you know, we agree on the problems. We agree that education costs too much, that healthcare costs too much, but we disagree on the solution. We think the solution is empowering individuals and, you know, facing up to some of these problems and coming up with real, you know, solutions for them. Gary Johnson's talking about a 20% reduction in the federal budget, you know, actually cutting spending, something that, you know, I know the Reason Commentariat would like somebody to finally do.
I think they might even say, you know, why only 20%? You know, why not 200%? But, you know, we'll take the cuts where they come. I was just looking at a USA Today Rock the Vote poll, and one thing that's interesting of millennials is that 62% agree that with the statement there are more important ways or better ways of making a difference than voting, which kind of leans towards the idea that maybe we can get beyond politics. And talk a little bit about that, because it strikes me that that's part of the Libertarian Party's difficulty. It's specifically about politics. It's a political party. But, you know, what it's kind of selling is the idea that, look, let's have as little politics in our lives as possible, where we have to agree 51% at least to do something, because everything that's interesting is happening outside of politics, beyond politics. And it seems particularly with millennials that we have this issue where on the one hand they want what government can give them, but then on the other hand they're reaping the benefits of an economy that is largely unregulated or you know, grows out of a kind of permissionless innovation. Is there a dichotomy there, and is there a narrative that the LP has worked out to, you know, kind of make what's clear there, so that people are like, yeah, we have to evacuate politics if we want to have a better future?
We can't evacuate politics, because politics will not leave us alone, and that's just the sad reality of, mm-hmm. of representative democracy, is that politics will always be there. And the Libertarian Party provides, you know, to harken back to another ad campaign that people remember, we're essentially the un-party. You know, we are a political party dedicated to the idea of individual empowerment and the reduction in government control, which is the opposite of every other political party on the ballot. We're one of the only, as far as the only one of any note, ideological parties left in America that actually has principles and beliefs about the proper role of the government. But the reason why more people should be involved in the Libertarian Party, the reason people should not identify as independent, but should re-register libertarian, is there's strength in numbers. There's value in creating a voting bloc that very clearly wants more individual freedom so that candidates understand what they have to do to get those votes, what they have to do to earn those votes. You know, the Democratic nominee with the assistance of Tom Steyer is dropping about $55 million into attacking Gary Johnson and, to a lesser extent, the Green Party candidate, and basically trying to shame people and scold them into not voting for somebody who represents their ideals. And that we have to show that that won't work anymore. You know, the first president, Clinton, hopefully the last, but we'll see. He didn't have any particular interest in 1991 in deficit spending, in reducing government debt at all. But after Perot hit 19% of the popular vote in 1992, all of a sudden, that President Clinton got real interested in the national deficit and managed to give us a surplus. And he did it, I don't think, out of any clear moral principle or education. He did it because he wanted to be a two-term president. And he knew that there were 19% of the country that, for them, that was one of their driving issues. And so he either co-opted it or he lost.
Talk about some of the other LP races that are not at the presidential level that always gets you know, most of the attention. Are there other candidates that are running under the Libertarian Party banner that you're particularly kind of hopped up on, or that you think point to a future for the LP that is bright?
Yeah. So Mark Miller in Texas is running for Texas Railroad Commissioner, which actually is the agency that regulates oil and gas.
Right. Yeah. And talk a little bit about that, because this if you're not familiar with the kind of uniqueness of Texas politics, the Railroad Commission is a gigantic ball of wax. Right.
Oh, yeah. They run, you know, one of the dominant industries in the state, and nobody knows it because they're called Railroad Commission. Mark Miller has been endorsed. He's running as a Big L Libertarian and has been endorsed by every major newspaper in Texas that does endorsements, including the Houston Chronicle, the San Antonio
Express,
whatever that. I think it's the Express. Yeah. And the Dallas Morning News. The Austin American Statesman does not endorse in that. I don't think they do endorsements at all. But every paper that does endorsements has endorsed him. And one of the sad facts of Texas politics is he may not win anyway, because Texas still has this relic of a bygone age of the straight ticket voting device. And so if a Republican just goes in and says Republican, it's going to vote for the corrupt crony who's running as the Republican nominee, even though Mr. Miller is well more competent to take the job. And that's one of the things that's been a little different now is I can say with confidence that when it comes to executive experience and the temperament to be president of the United States, that our party has nominated the most qualified person objectively. Mm-hmm. It's not backed by, you know, as much money as the other two candidates, but we have objectively the most qualified candidate running. And I can say that about the race in Texas. And there's a lot more races around the country where you can say that about the Libertarian candidate, that the Libertarian candidate, we're attracting talented people who are competent and capable of doing the job that they're running for. And that has been a big credibility boost. That's why our Senate candidates all over the country and congressional candidates are polling at the 10 and 12 and 13%.
Talk about who is a Senate candidate and who's a House candidate that, you know, it particularly rises to the top based on that estimation, that these are credible candidates with experience or who are as good or better than the people that they're running against from a major party.
You know, for Senate candidates, it's probably a tie, my two favorite. There's Lily Tang Williams in Colorado, who has just a great immigrant story. And then Paul Stanton in Florida is running against Marco Rubio and whoever the Democrat is. And again, he's running into the same problems that Johnson is, where they refuse to debate him. They're gaming the numbers and saying that this poll doesn't qualify, even though it shows you're over the threshold, and doing everything they can to avoid putting a third option on the stage. Because, you know, when you have this moldy sandwich shop where they sell moldy ham and cheese and moldy pastrami, they don't want you pulling up in a taco truck saying, hey, these are delicious, they cost the same amount of money, and there's no mold on them. They want you to pick which one am I going to nibble around the edges and which one looks like the crust is a little less green.
This is there's amazing footage floating around of Jesse Ventura from 2000 with Donald Trump, of all people, talking about the absolute need to be on the debate stage. And Ventura talked about how he only became governor of Minnesota because he was able to get on the stage with Hubert Humphrey III, who was the favorite, and Norm Coleman, the Democrat son of Hubert Humphrey, you know, the favorite son of Minnesota politics, and Norm Coleman, the mayor of St. Paul. And Ventura got on the stage and ended up wiping it with both of those guys and became a two-term governor of Minnesota. So, you know, in a way, they're right not to, you know, to try and keep that third option off the stage at all costs.
Yeah, no, it's strategically correct. It's just, you know, they're colluding in the rigging of American politics. Yeah. And the fact that we tolerate that, you know, that's the other reason why we need to maximize the vote totals for Gary Johnson, because every person who votes for Johnson says, yeah, you have a rigged system where it's corrupt and they collude with the media, they collude with each other. You know, this the whole thing looks like pro wrestling at this point to me. But we're the people who are not going to tolerate it. We're the people who are going to stand up and say, you know what, one of those bad people may win, but there's no prize for helping, so I'm not going to participate in that.
Is this a strategic shift, a long-term strategic shift for the LP to run candidates who are, you know, and I'm not trying to be divisive or invidious here, but people who are ready, willing, and able to actually govern. You know, that's, you had mentioned Michael Bednarik, the 2008 presidential, 2004 presidential candidate for the LP. Not a person who's held elective office before, with somebody like Gary Johnson, and then you add on Bill Weld. This is, you know, this is an incredible ticket from an experience point of view. Is this a new phase for the LP to say, you know what, we're not simply running informational campaigns, although we obviously you still do that and you talk about principles and ideology, but these are living, breathing people who should be holding the levers of government?
Yes, I think, and it's a shift that's both taken by the delegates who decide who our nominee will be. We have no pledged delegates at our national convention. So, you know, they've listened to all of the options and they've had the opportunity to have the more ideological versus the more, you know, experienced government kind of moderate candidates. And they've chosen who they've chosen. And it goes back and forth in the LP on that. But what it's showing is that our strength as a party and the growth that we've had over the last 45 years, we're attracting better candidates. You know, I was in conversations with candidates who had been eliminated from the old party nomination process this election cycle, who were exploring the possibility of seeking a Libertarian nomination, something that Johnson actually did, I guess, in 2012. And that kind of consideration is something that we haven't had in the past. You know, it was a big deal when Congressman Barr actually sought our nomination in 08 because we hadn't had a former congressman except for Ron Paul.
Right.
I guess he counts.
And he was a former and a future congressman, although I guess nobody knew it at the time, right, in 1988.
Indeed. So, but we're getting better people coming in, and a lot of it has to do with – The Libertarian Party, you know, I don't know if you read Dan Savage's concern trolling about third parties, but the Libertarian Party is actually doing all the things Dan Savage pretends that we're not doing. We have active affiliates in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. We run down ballot candidates. We run candidates in the midterms. We work to organize. And we've become a political force in a way that other attempts haven't worked, you know, like with the Green Party getting on Nader's coattails for so long. When he finally decided he was tired of running for president, they didn't have any other alternative power centers. They didn't have any bench, and it really gutted them as a political party.
Talk a little bit about, though, how ballot access works. For instance, I vote in Ohio, and I just got my absentee ballot, and Johnson and Welder at the top of the docket there, you know, in the names listed, but they're not listed with a party affiliation, whereas Jill Stein, who's further down, is listed with a party affiliation. What, you know, how does ballot access kind of compound the marginal nature of independent parties or of third parties? And how does the Libertarian Party address that to overcome it so that you're not spending as much time getting on ballots as actually running candidates?
Yeah, the old parties cheat with both hands to try and keep us off of the ballot. They pass laws that are restrictive. They set fairness rules where basically, you know, what they consider fair is you have to run a 10K before we get to the start of the marathon. And then you can run the marathon on equal terms after having already expended your energy. You know, in Ohio, there's good evidence that Governor Kasich colluded with some political operatives of his to find what the court referred to as a guileless dupe to kick the Libertarian Party off the ballot because he was afraid that Charlie Earle would be a problem for his reelection. And that kind of cheating goes on all the time. And we just expect it now. What we've been doing is, you know, fighting back in court. We've been spending the money and doing the organization to get over these ballot access hurdles because it is this chicken and egg. They'll say, well, you're not on all the ballots, so you're not serious. But then they'll make it very hard to get on all the ballots because they know that if they do that, they can delegitimize us. And, you know, one of the goals that we have after November 9th, after I take a little bit of a nap, is to go out in going into the midterm elections and one, get party access back in Ohio. That's probably going to cost about $100,000, give or take, and really build off of these gains that we're making in 2016 to retrench that back into organization in the states and improvement of the picture, because we're playing a long game. We're not focusing on the presidential election for its own purposes. We're focusing on the presidential election as another stepping stone to eventually displacing one or both of the old political parties.
Talk a little bit about how you got involved in all of this. You're a lawyer by trade, and we'll try not to hold that against you. But what was your – did you have a particular Damascus Road experience that said, okay, you know what, I want to run the LP and I want to crack double digits? You know, how did you end up here?
So it all started when I was 12, and my dad would take me to Maricopa County Libertarian Party meetings here in Phoenix. Where I met people like Ernie Hancock. And I read a copy of Berglund's Libertarianism in One Lesson. It made sense to me. And so I've never politically identified as anything other than a libertarian. And then when I got out of undergrad, my undergrad's computer science, I was living in Maryland. And a few years later, ended up being the state chair there. After law school, I moved out to Colorado to be a public defender. Keeping poor people out of cages, and ended up the vice chair of the Colorado Party. And, you know, I've been to national conventions, every one since 2000 in Anaheim. And what I had seen from the national committee was sort of a lack of strategic vision and a sense that they weren't libertarians. Sometimes if you've come from a different party, there's this need to prove yourself to the people that you left behind. Kind of like when people leave a religion, like they leave Catholicism or Judaism, they always still have those ties back and they still want the respect of the people, even though they did leave them. And there's a self-esteem that comes from being a second-generation libertarian, where I don't want to be liked or respected by, you know, a Reince Priebus or a Debbie Wasserman Schultz. I don't need their respect. And if I had their respect, I would probably question what I was doing. I want to, you know, essentially displace those parties, destroy, kill, take out back in an alley and, you know, put two bullets in the back of the head, whatever kind of metaphor you like. And, you know, having never done anything else, it's all I know how to do. And having, you know, been a public defender, now I sell used cars, so way more integrity. you know, I understand what it is to be a happy warrior fighting against odds that are stacked against you, fighting against a state that has more resources than you, and savoring the victories that you get anyway, and using tactics that are appropriate to the nature of the struggle.
Are you literally a used car salesman?
Yeah, our family owns the oldest used car dealership in the city of Phoenix. My grandfather started in 1942 after he moved here from South Bend, Indiana.
Let me ask you then, is there an analogy in politics to what's going on in car selling, including used cars and certainly new cars as well, where, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, certainly 40 or 50 years ago, it was a totally asymmetrical relationship where a customer would come in and they didn't really know, you know, if the car it was held together by baling wire and chewing gum, or if it had really only been driven to church once a week by a little old lady. Now in used cars, there's all sorts of systems in place. If you go to Edmunds.com or you go use Carfax or whatever, you can actually get pretty good records or more information, certainly, on, you know, what the history of a particular car is. And that gives the customer more leverage with the or, you know, more even standing with the seller. Is there, you know, first off, is that true? Is the negotiation between seller and customer more equalized now than it was in the past in auto sales? And secondly, is there an analogy in politics, assuming that, you know, I feel this way, you know, when I buy a car and I realize, of course, nobody is ever going to sell you a car that they don't want to sell you, you know, at a price that they can't really afford. But I can get a better deal than I could have gotten 25, 30 years ago. Is there something analogous shifting in politics that we can be optimistic about?
Yeah, I think the information that's available now in cars really pushes the focus back on value. You can't just, you know, do some high pressure sales tactics and convince people to pay lots of money for not a lot of car. You have to actually create value. You have to earn trust. You know, we operate a used car dealership with integrity, which is part of the reason why I left the active practice of law to be the third generation in the business. You know,
what a damning,
it's like a unicorn,
yeah,
right?
I was going to say, what a damning statement on the law, right? The practice of law, that you would leave it to become a used car salesman because you wanted higher status and more integrity. But there it is.
But that extra information really does level the playing field. And I think that is the part, the reason that the Democrat can't close the deal with voters is she comes off as shady and untrustworthy. And there's an entire generation that just values authenticity, value being told the truth. If I have a car where the Carfax says, you know, it was in an accident, that I can still sell that car to somebody. I can still convince a customer to buy that car by disclosing it and saying, look, you know, it wasn't an accident. As you look around, you know, we're looking at the bodywork, we're looking at the frame and stuff. It's in good shape. It's been driven for another, you know, 5 years after this accident that showed up on the report. It's a good car. So, you know, these things are not necessarily deal breakers,
right,
but they're things that you have to address. And I think that that's the way that the Democratic campaign has just failed to deal with all the WikiLeaks documents, because they show her as duplicitous and conniving. And rather than deal with those things head on and say, look, you know, it's a calculated campaign, instead it's like, oh, blame the Russians. Look, it's right. The Russians. It's the Russians. I don't even know if they're fake.
And you know, now we don't really have to worry about it, or we, the Democrats don't have to worry about it as much because Trump is, you know, I guess the kindest thing that's been said about him is that he's a dumpster fire. you have to give the Democrats credit, at least over the past three or so elections, they've picked the right Republican to run against, it seems.
Right. No, there was an internal memo from the Podesta emails that showed that they were actively working with their contacts in the media to elevate what they referred to as the three Pied Piper candidates in the Republican field. Mr. Cruz, Mr. Carson, and the gentleman who ended up getting nominated.
Right.
And, you know, so it's like she didn't just rig her nomination. She actually rigged his nomination, too. And then fed stories to friendly media to, you know, make sure the coverage of it was what they expected. And so the more she feeds into this narrative, you know, people don't trust her, the more she kind of stonewalls and dissembles and tries to smear the Russians and has Tim Kaine go on TV and say, you know, gosh, I don't know if those speeches are even real, to which I think he got asked by Jake Tapper.
Right.
Well, you could ask her, and didn't really have a good answer for that.
He pulls out the harmonica then, right, and goes into Song Remains the Same extended solo. So
indeed,
you're not worried, you know, in a way that it seems, you know, clearly Trump is troubled by transparency, if we define transparency as things from your past that are unseemly that come back to light. Neither is Hillary Clinton. But from a libertarian perspective, you don't worry about that.
I don't. I have probably the most honest candidate in politics. There was a funny satirical piece where it was like Johnson's leaked phone conversations or something. It was like, yeah, he took some Oreos or something.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, he's just such a wholesome, honest guy. I am not aware of Gary Johnson ever lying to anybody that I know of. And this is not a business in which people always tell the truth. And I think that that's also, you know, that's kind of how I try and run the Libertarian Party. You know, we have a very transparent system of governance. I took no sides in the nomination process. Our official, you know, National Committee business list is publicly accessible. You can, you know, read our correspondence. It's like open meetings. You know, I don't fear giving away our strategies, because our strategies are to fight for, you know, every American to have a life that they choose, as long as they're not hurting anyone or taking their stuff. And I don't think that that's a strategy that can successfully be co-opted by the old parties, because they're too beholden to their cronies. And if they did successfully co-opt it, then I got to, you know, more freedom and I get to work a lot less.
Well, we will leave it there. That sounds great. We've been talking with the Libertarian Party National Chairman, Nicholas Sarwark. Thank you so much for spending some time with Reason's podcast.
Thank you, Nick.
This is Nick Gillespie for Reason and the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe, rate, and review our podcasts, our videos, everything at iTunes, at SoundCloud, at RSS feeds, wherever you find them. Thanks so much.